listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Angelique Kidjo, a musician whose voice you don't just hear, you feel. Her music conquers, the fusion of electrifying African polyrhythms married with Western melodies penetrates your cells with an intensity and beauty that transmits the broader message Kidjo has been sharing for over three decades. This Grammy Award-winning musician speaks a universal language through her multilingual lyrics. She sings in five different languages, her native Fon and Yoruba, as well as English, French, and Swahili. Days away from the release of her 11th studio album, titled Eve, to be followed by an international tour, it is truly a gift to have Kidjo in our presence at the LA Public Library. But until now, few knew that this powerful voice is also a soaring storyteller. In her new memoir, Spirit Rising, My Life, My Music, Kidjo takes us to her native Benin, where she grew up in a musical family. Her parents believed in letting children speak freely and emphasized the importance of education. She developed an activist spirit at a young age, incensed by the injustices she saw in Africa and the world. This spirit has remained with her, a constant in her music over time, continent, and culture. Bold in her determination to follow that voice, Kidjo relocated to Paris, where she became part of a burgeoning world music scene that laid the foundation for future collaborations with other luminaries like Peter Gabriel, Santana, Bono, Ziggy Marley, Alicia Keys, and Miriam Makeba, among many, many others. Kidjo is also a tireless activist, serving as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador and founder of the Batonga Foundation, which promotes higher education for girls in Africa. The Guardian UK includes her in their list of the world's 100 most inspiring women. As Bill Clinton has written, the only thing bigger than Angelique Kidjo's voice is her heart. In dialogue with Kidjo tonight is Lorraine Ali, accomplished author and award-winning journalist and current music editor for the Los Angeles Times. Ali has crossed many international borders to report on music and culture, from the Buena Vista Social Club in Havana to Palestinian rappers in the occupied territories. She is currently working on a book about the plight of her Iraqi family following the 2003 invasion. And just in case you're feeling any trepidation during the performance, you are invited to get out of your seats and dance. Please let us welcome Lorraine Ali and Angelique Kidjo.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here tonight, and thank you. Couldn't happen without you.
Thanks for being here. That's a good thing.
Yes.
Women talking to women.
Me too. I've spent the past couple weeks with your book, and you...
I hope you didn't get bored.
Oh.
Okay, good.
No. I'm sitting here, aren't I? No.
All right, okay.
I did not
just
get
checking,
bored.
Just checking.
Your life story truly is amazing, but what I really love about this book is it has a lot of the same qualities of your music, the humanity, the warmth, the humor, and that really comes through, and it's just a wonderful read, and it has a lot of those qualities that your music has. So we don't have a lot of time, so I wanted to jump right in. Was there anything in particular that sort of was the catalyst for writing this memoir, or was it something that had been bubbling up? Because I have a sense you probably have a lot of things bubbling up, but...
I think that
what really started this book is the passing of my father in 2008 that took all of us by surprise. Because my father was a man of moderation, never drinks, never smoked, never speak louder than anybody else. And out of the blue, he has liver cancer. And the doctor, the family doctor, didn't understand where it comes from. And I was in denial of it, and my brothers and sisters keep on telling me, you gotta go see Dad. He's doing really bad. I said, I saw him 6 months ago. I know he lost weight, but he's gonna be okay. And then my husband said, you gotta go. You just gotta go. So I finished the American tour, and I have 3 days off before I start the European tour. And I just commute. I spent 24 hours with my father, and I arrived in the evening, and I didn't want to go to the house. And he called and said, I want to see you. So I went to see him that night, and I really have to brace myself not to start screaming because he was a completely different man. Mm-hmm. And my sister have warned me, but I'm like, it can't be that bad. And then my mom said to me, sit and have something to eat. And I didn't understand what it was she was trying to do because my father was not eating that much. And I sat down for the first time in 2 weeks, my father ate something. Wow. So I went back home to my sister and I couldn't sleep that night. And she was telling me, the doctor don't have that much of a hope. But me, I'm a believer. I'm an optimist person. I was still thinking that he's gonna make it through. And my mom was in denial of it. So I spent the whole next day talking to my father, and he was, at one point he looked at me and he said, why did you come and see me? You think I'm gonna die? I said, Dad, that one is not up to me to say. I just want to see you. But he said, you're in the middle of a tour, right? I said, yes, I have 3 days off. And he said to me, do not cancel any of your concert to come and see me, whatever the outcome of my disease will be. Because you were born to do this, I don't want to be in the one person in the world that's going to stop you from doing it. You go back and do it. And then he paused, and then he said, I heard you receive a Grammy. What is a Grammy? And before I left, I was like, I should take the Grammy to show my father. But I'm like, I'm not going to do that. And I regret I didn't do. Mm. So I explained to him what the Grammy was. And then he paused again. He has that kind of humor that you can't help it. You just go, okay. And then he paused and he said, so finally you find a country that can recognize talent? I'm like, well, if you say so. And after that, I came back home and still in my heart, I think he was gonna be okay. Then 2 weeks after that meeting, I was in Helsinki and getting ready to do my concert. And I have one of my cousins that work in London that always come and follow me from time to time. Mm. And she arrived at the moment the tour manager was telling me, Jean was calling, my husband was calling, and I was on the phone. And he told me, your father just passed away. And I just fell on the ground. And I was screaming off my head. And my cousin said, you can't do this to my uncle. He's not the type of person that will allow you to do this. You have a show to do, you gotta do it. Yeah. See, I can't sing. I said, you got to do this. So I gathered myself together and I went on that stage. Till today, I can't tell you how I pulled this concert together. Okay. I sang 90 minutes, and at the end, it was like somebody just take the life off of my body. I couldn't do nothing anymore. I just went back to crying. But the public was asking for an encore. So I said, they said, the musician, they are so graceful. They said, we'll hold you. We'll help you to the stage. So they hold my hand, and I get there, and I was crying. I was barely seeing anything. And I said to the public, I'm sorry. I don't have it in me anymore. My father just passed away today, and I wish I could do another encore. And they all stand up. It was a standing ovation. And I came back home. I didn't know how to live with myself. Then the funeral started, and I went to the funeral, and people, the church was packed with people that wanted to see the star, not a young girl that is mourning her father. And I was just like, can you leave me alone? This is a moment where I just have to be with my family. My brothers and sisters, they were very gracious about this. My mom was in so much pain that she was there, but she was not there at the same time. And then the priest started asking me to come and sing song. It's just, and I was just like, I can't do this. I'm not here to sing. It's not a concert.
But that's so hard because, you know, your father was so, your parents were so supportive about that, and your father had played such a key role in singing.
That's what was the most difficult one, that I was not given the opportunity to say goodbye to my father. So when I came back, it was stuck in my throat. So I'll be crying. Then one night I have a dream of my father saying, stop crying, let me go. So at that time, I would listen a lot to Gould, and would listen to the variation of Goldberg. And all those words in my head, I was just putting on everything I can find and hang on to. I was just putting the music through. And my friends started telling me, you're talking about your father all the time. Why don't you buy a camera, sit in front of the camera, and talk about your father? Just everything that you didn't tell your father before, just tell to the camera your memories. So I started doing that. And a couple of 2 years after that, I've been approached by HarperCollins to write my journey. And I transcribed the video and I start talking to the ghostwriter. It took a year before we start really writing because she never have written a book before. We've known each other. I mean, I always say there's no coincidences. She is the wife of a friend of my husband. We do music together. Her husband was a sound engineer. So they live in Philadelphia. They used to live in New York. So they came to visit and say, oh, we just have a meeting with HarperCollins, and I'm going to write, they asked me to write a memoir of an African singer. My husband was like, huh? what is that? So because we had such a close relationship, it took a while for her to just get into it. Mm. So because of my crazy schedule, when I was in New York, she would come from Philadelphia, or we'd do Skype. And she would keep on asking me and I was telling her, don't repeat the same thing. I want my voice to be heard.
Well, because what we were talking about backstage, writing a book is quite different from writing songs or music.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Painful. You have 3 minutes for a song, and then a book is like, what, how many pages?
Your blood and your life.
It's difficult. It's very difficult. Yeah. But it helps me a lot that I was able to write this book, to come to accept really that my father is not gonna come back. No. That as he said before to us, it's only my body that's gonna leave you, my spirit will always be with you. So I keep that in mind every time I'm about to drop a ball. I'm like, my father won't let you do this. So come back to myself and say, okay, let's go for it.
Ah, okay. And you know, that it really comes across in the book, and there's, when in the beginning of the book, you kind of start where you start when you're a young girl, and you got your start singing with your mom's theater group.
Yes.
There's a little scene in the book that just sort of, when I read it, I thought, you know, this is where it all started. So I was going to read it.
Go ahead.
Outside at night, beyond our rusted red front door, the world looks so different. And by the way, you're like 6 years old here, 7 years old here.
Yes. Six.
Okay. And this is her, she's starting to sing, and her father's starting to take her out at night when she's supposed to be sleeping like other kids to sing with this theater group.
Yeah.
Outside at night, beyond our rusted red front door, the world looks so different. I was used to seeing our little street during the day with chickens and pigs and goats roaming around. Now I see the closed mosque across the street and nearby the dark cinema. I'm going to say this wrong. I'm sorry.
Le Bénin.
Thank you. The theater where we went on Sunday afternoons to see karate movies and westerns. Back then, my father had a huge white secondhand Citroen. I wasn't allowed to ride in the front seat. My parents didn't think it was safe. So I sat in the back and watched my father drive. He was a tall, handsome man, always calm and elegant. He loved wearing hats and had a sleek mustache I could see in the rearview mirror when the lights from passing cars flashed by. After a while, I would hang out the window and try and take in this new scene. During the day, the streets were packed with people, but at night, the vendors were out cooking lamb stew that I can't say either. I'm sorry.
Chachanga.
Thank you. by the flickering lights of their kerosene lamps, the air was filled with wood smoke. I thought, my friends didn't have a chance to see this. I'm seeing this because I'm a singer. This was the beginning of my discovery of new worlds through music. Love that. It's just like, it just seems like the beginning of, you know, sort of like your consciousness as a singer, but like as a person that puts their experience into music. And you can hear this when you listen to your music.
Yeah, it was those moments where I was like, wow, I wish I could describe what I'm seeing from the window of the car to my friends when I go back to school. But the thing is, you can't talk about it because sometimes my father have to take me to a nightclub where my brother was playing and I have to sing with them and I'm not allowed to be there because they are serving alcohol and you have prostitutes all around the place. My father would sneak me through the kitchen quickly and then sneak me out. I'm like, that's when the phone started. Like, can I stay here? He's like, no, home. I'm like, damn, man. And my father was like, you're going to bed. I'm like, how am I going to sleep with all this excitement in my blood? And my father said, you'll find a way to sleep because you, nothing stop you from sleeping because I can sleep. Gee, I can sleep. Oh, my God, I love sleeping or what? But after those, it was the moment where you come back and you look at the roof. I mean, the expression looking at the roof, not being able to sleep, never occurred to me till those moments where you come back home and everything starts going on your mind and you are reliving the song that you have sang. My mom did that purple dress to me, and then I was, every weekend I would wash my dress and put it there. I'm like, ooh, I'm going to
go. And she made it, right?
Yeah, she made it. Yeah. I mean, my parents were too poor to buy anything. She does all of our clothes, our uniform and everything that we wear. So I was just like, I'm going to go there. Ooh, no, no, no. And I put my dress on, and my sister said, look at you. I said, you are supposed to be sleeping. You're supposed to be up like me. Because you can't sing. My sister said, yeah, I know you can't. My sister can't sing. She said, every time I open my mouth to sing, I have the feeling that frog's going to fall from the sky. It is true. It's painful. I'm the only one that can sing in the family. And my other sister, she sings like somebody's quicking the life out of her.
I'm guessing your sister's not out here, correct?
No, they're not that. They said, I mean, she always said that, God is not fair. Why can't I sing? Why can't I have the boobs you have? I say, hey, you're taller than me. You playing basketball, I want to play basketball, I can't play basketball. So am I going to blame God for that too? I got to have something, y'all.
So as you're moving through in the book and in your life, when your career was kind of starting out, but you were still in Benin, Benin fell under the power of a totalitarian government, dictatorship, meaning that freedom of what artists could do, you know, the music that they could put out on record, on stage, obviously has been quashed. So I just wanted to talk about how that affected you. Obviously, you had to leave because of that, but also as an artist, like, you resolved to push through it, because it seems like you are at your best when you have something you have to push through.
Yep, it's true. Well, I always say to people that live in country where freedom has never been put in question, that when it's not taken away from you, you don't understand what it is. Mm. And when you have freedom, cherish it, protect it at any cost, because once it's gone, it's hell on earth. Literally. The thing that happened with the communist regime was the first time in my life I learned not to trust people. Oh. I grew up in a household where everybody was welcome. You never question if they have any intent, bad intention, good intention. It never crossed my mind. Suddenly, our house that was a free zone speech home becomes just completely upside down. Because you don't know who the government is using to spy on you. You don't know if your phone is tapped. You can't trust nobody. You can't trust your brothers, your cousins, your aunties. Your friend is just like, hell. And then you're like, when you want to speak, then you have to think. Because we are so used to speak up our mind before the communist regime arrived.
Right.
Because that's what my father and my mom want. They say, speak. If you don't speak, how we help you? We are not God. We can't read your brain. Just speak up. And that freedom of speech was the first thing that started affecting my life. Mm-hmm. And I would cry sometimes because I have something to say to my father. And you see my father so afraid for me to say something that might be a danger for him or me, because I have that tendency of saying I don't have filter. I just go boom and then, and then people go, oh, you can't say that. I just did. The elephant is in the room. Everybody's turning around. And I'm like, hey, what the hell, man? Come on, let me tell the truth. And then it's hell with it. And that was taken away from me. And one of the things that my father and my mother used to tell me all the time, they always said to me, your music cannot be linked to a political party because they come and they go. Mm. If you want to keep your freedom of speech and your artistical freedom, don't sing for a political party, because once they're gone, everybody's going to look like you as a traitor. Don't do that. Don't just keep it. Say whatever you want to say, but don't link it to a political party. So I never write anything directly to a political party in place. The second thing that was really difficult for me was that it was imposed on us, everybody in the country, to call your parents comrade. I'm like, how am I going to call my father comrade? Are you crazy? Yeah. And you call your mom comrade? I'm like, you got to be behind closed door to call your mom mom and to call your dad daddy. And that was like, it's just like something that I could not grapple with, I can live with. Yeah. And the third thing was, you can write the music that you want. The radio that we used to listen, the radio was open there. We have traditional music. We have music from America, from England, from India, from all over the place. Boom, finish. So you pick up the phone. If you say hello, you're a traitor. You have to say, Prêt pour la révolution, la lutte continue. Ready for the revolution, the fight continues. That's what you have to say. I'm like,
wow.
And I was just like boiling. And my father was like, please don't say a word. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. So I was lucky enough, I was touring. I would go to other countries, come back, and one day I just couldn't escape. So I have to do the show for the ECOWAS, the meeting, economical meeting from the West African leaders. And I did not like it. I did not want to go. The military was everywhere. I mean, it's just like crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And here you are on the stage, singing for all those head of state, and they all look at you like, well, what part of your body can we touch? I'm like, filthy people. Get away from me. Get out of them, lamb. I mean, if this is what singing means, I ain't singing anymore.
Wow.
And my father said, this is the time you have to make a decision, you have to leave. Because I'm seeing you boiling, and I know you.
How old are you at this point?
I was 21, something like that. And I was like, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
So it took a year, probably, for us to plan it, to find the opportunity. Which event can be linked to my escape? So one of my cousins was getting married 2 years after that. My mom and my dad was they were the witness of the wedding. So we have to put them in the secret. Apart from my mom, my dad, and my brothers and my grandmother, nobody knew. Nobody in the country knew. So they agreed to be part of it. That was a danger too. But the house was very close to the airport, which means I won't come back home once I left for the party. So we all dress up, do the church, do the city hall, and prepare everything. And then you see me in my evening gown. The last night I was leaving, I was not happy. I was not really smiling on that picture because I was still, my heart was still pounding in my heart there. In my chest, I'm like, am I going to make it? Am I going to make it? Or am I going to end up in jail? That was the question.
And people knew who you were at this point.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, you were known.
And if you don't know it, then you don't leave your country then.
Yeah.
So I went, and the time came. I have a special plastic bag I put my clothes in that I'm going to wear and put my other dress in. My suitcase was closed. I have to make a little plan after that. I have to be ready to just jump and get out of there fast. So my father dropped me not in front of the door of the airport because if his car is seen, they'll know he brought me there. So I have to drag my suitcase, enter the airport. And the leader at that time was from the north, because what happened with the colonization is that the city that were on the water, on the sea, close to the sea, are the one that have the first entrance of the colonizer. So they established there. And they develop the southern part, and the northern part is less developed. So what they do is that they divide mentally. I mean, they create the division, they brainwash both sides for us not to ever be together. I can remember when going to school, people telling you, people from the north, they are stupid. I'm like, we're from the same country. Why are you talking to them? And it's just all those brainwashing thing that was going on. So because of the revenge that the new president wanted to take on the southern part, that was being the leader of the country since independence. That was the whole point of the coup, the coup that happened. And every agent that worked for the government, you have the southerner and you have somebody from the north. So they watch each other. It's just like they create not a kind of confidence surrounding is just always paranoid all the time. That's how the fear is installed in every different ways for you, for them to keep the power. So when I walked into the airport.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you get through that?
I saw the guy from the South. He was there. And he used to do music with my brother. He saw me. He almost had a heart attack. He go, what are you doing here? I said, I got to leave, man. He goes, I'm turning my back. I didn't see you. I ain't stamping. No passport. Get out of here. Get into that plane before my colleague come. He's in the bathroom. Just run. I have never run so fast in my entire life. And then that time, you don't have suitcases with wheel. So I just grabbed my hand. I'm like, woohoo, man. Hey, hello. Come on, man. You got to get out of there. And I run. We don't have satellite where you get in the plane. You just go on the stairs. So I'm like, woohoo. And just like that. And I was born with asthma, so I didn't even think about I'm gonna probably have a heart attack right now. I just wanna get out of here. And I gave my suitcase to check it, and then I grabbed all the rest. And I get into the plane and I sat down in the plane. Literally, I put my seatbelt on and like this. I'm like, take off, take off, take off, take off. I was talking to the captain. I'm going to get the hell out of here. And I only start breathing when the plane took off. And I can see my city through the window. I'm like, hallelujah, I'm out of here.
Wow.
And that was my experience.
Well, it sounds like also, you know, once you were in Paris and, you know, you're there as an immigrant, there's all this possibility, but, you know, there's other singers, other performers that have gone there from Africa, and it kind of just flattened them. I mean, it was difficult, that life is difficult. Mm-hmm. But it also brought up these other things, you know, that I was reading in your book in terms about dealing with inequality and racism and things that you didn't actually deal with half as much in your own country as when you got to Paris. So it kind of seems to me, just from reading this, that that was a point where some of the activism or some of the ideas about social equality, that stuff started kind of making it into your music? Or was that, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but...
No, the thing about me settling in France is that I had a lengthy conversation with my parents before I leave. Because I know at one point they were worried sick. And I was seeing them doesn't know what to do with me. So I went one night and sat on the bed and said, what is the worry? I need to talk with you guys about it. Yeah. And both of them were worried about prostitution and drugs. Those are the two things that they were really afraid of because they know that I have the resources. And I said to them, Mom and Dad, I can't promise you here. If I have to prostitute, I'd rather not eat and save the money till I come back home. I don't care if I end up in jail. But that's not going to be my choice, and drug is not part of my life also. So when I left, all my thought was, I'm going to grow up now. I'm going to make my own decisions. If I make mistake, it's all on me. If I made the bad one, the good one, it's all on me. But I was not expecting France to wait for me and get me the red carpet. That never crossed my mind, ever. The fact that I knew that I was going to start from zero was already a challenge that was bubbling in my blood. I'm like, woohoo, man, I'm gonna learn some new stuff. I'm ready for it. I was ready for it. I preferred that than the misery of staying in my country, not being able to speak up my mind.
Right.
I just like, that would be better for hell for me than to be living in Benin. So when I arrived, my brother had a band of musicians that he used to play drum with. And he said to me, it's not gonna be easy, but I know you. When you put your mind to something, you always do what you have to do. But be careful of racism. People are going to make comment because when I came here speaking the French I was speaking, they make fun out of me too because you speak a very good French. You don't. I never swear in my entire life till I arrive in France. I'm like, my father, you swear, and you're a woman. He doesn't talk to you. Say, I don't like that. It's not sexy. It's not nice. You don't swear. I mean, it's very, I don't even know any swearing in my language, to tell the truth. So here I am in school for the first year, and every time I speak, they go, here she comes again. We need the encyclopedia to understand what she's talking about. And I'm like, but it's your language. They say, why can't you say the F word and this word? I'm like, I don't know those words. They say, we'll teach you. I'm like, no, I don't want to hear about it.
It took me a year, and then after I start cursing like nobody else, I'm telling you fast. But the thing is, it's every time I go back to Benin, it just disappears, because as soon as I start talking to my mom, I'm like, I can't swear. Not gonna happen.
Right, no, and it's just gonna happen. Parents,
it's
never.
Just like you. Yeah. I mean, all the stuff that you raised with come back, and racism is everywhere. Even in Africa, you see it. When I was growing up in Benin, all those expatriate people that come from France, everywhere that come to work there, they have their way of seeing things, of doing things. And sometimes I would be at the library of the French center, because that's where I do most of my homework, because my parents couldn't afford to get all the books for us, especially those classic of French literature like Molière or like Baudelaire. You have to go there because, my father couldn't afford to buy those. So one day I was in the library, and then one of the French guys that was doing his military service there, instead of going to the army, he came there. And he started blabbing, "You African, you stupid man. We come here to save you." I said, "Who are you saving, your ass or my ass?" It just came out of my mouth like that. I said, "Can you shut up? You sound so stupid. What are you doing here? You don't like it? Go back.
Yeah.
Go to the army. Come on." And then he goes, "I don't want to go to the army." I said, "No, come on. Can we talk now? What is wrong with you? You have a brain, I have a brain. Come on, let's discuss." And then he looked at me and say, "Huh?" I said, "Huh, what? Did you read Baudelaire?" He said, "Huh?" I said, "Did you read Molière?" He goes, "Huh?" I said, "Look, that's what I'm reading. Am I stupid?" He goes, "I didn't mean you." I said, "What do you mean? Because I can talk to you now. You say you don't mean me? What's wrong with you people? When you talk, don't generalize, don't put everybody in the same bucket."
Well, at the same time, when you were in Paris, and this is the 1980s, this is also a time when, like, the genre name of world music comes up.
And I hate that word.
Okay.
I
don't even know if I need to say
this.
It's this double-edged sword, though, because it is something that gave, like, your career some lift. But on the other hand, it is, like,
it
the most absurd, stupid term. Exactly.
It's just so, like, crazy, man.
Yeah, and it's like it's some solidified. It's like, well, here's this, and then there's world music. It's all out there, and it's just one thing.
True, it is true. You know how Miriam Makeba used to call it? Man, I'm never gonna forget that conversation we have after a festival we had. We played in a festival in Basel, in Switzerland, and then after that I went to her room and we discussed, and she was mad as hell. See, who is the stupid guy that sit down in an office and say, this is going to be the third world music, and then they think that third is not politically correct, and they remove it, they say, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, "Hey, can you calm down a little bit?" I hate those people. I'm like, "You can't say that." They say, "I don't hate them, but gee, I don't like when they give me names." I say, "Yeah, I don't like it either, but what are you going to do?" That's what they call it. And they say, she said, "Okay, let's discuss it differently. Their music come from Africa. So how should we call their music too?" We call them, it just come from world music, and we taken it and we watered it down and call it blues and R&B. I'm like, no, you're going too far. That's it. She was really mad about it.
Yeah.
And I understand that, because it's in the human nature to categorize things to be able to understand it,
right,
or
yeah,
to market it or whatever it is. I understand that. But I say, you want to market something, why don't you do it differently? Just put everything from alphabetical order. Why do you have to call this classic? Why do you have to call this called rock and roll, R&B? I mean, we ain't stupid. We can make up our mind, man. People that sell stuff to us, they think that we can't think. We cannot put 1 + 1 = 2. No, they got to do it for us. I'm not stupid. Don't tell me what I got to buy, man. I hate that.
Right.
I just hate it so much.
But I thought it was interesting because you got some criticism from people who were, what would you call them, like world music purists. I know, totally absurd. But I thought it was really interesting that your description of it, kind of what you wrote, and this is just one other thing I wanted to read from the book. I thought this was really great. In some ways, what is considered traditional music is actually quite modern. For over the course of the years, it has adapted and it has been enriched. If it hasn't modernized in this way, it would have disappeared. I always have a problem with people who see themselves as purists of African music. Once you talk to me of traditional music without having a clue about its evolution, They have a vision of some original fossilized thing that needs to be preserved like a museum piece. It's rather sectarian, rigid bias, as if Africa is some exotic thing that can't or shouldn't evolve. It's a Western fantasy, a belief in an imaginary primitive land that hasn't changed since Homo sapiens left Africa.
It's true.
I love that.
It's true.
So well put.
It's true. It is true. That's how I felt sometimes. And I have experiences like, I can't even say anything about it. Sometimes you meet journalists, they didn't even listen to your music. They start asking you questions and you're like, have you listened to my music? One of them say, no, I didn't. I don't have to. I'm like, so why are you talking to me? And he's asking you stupid questions. Say, what make you say that your music is African?
Oh, no.
I'm like, what make you think that I'm African? He can answer that. Yeah. So you don't listen to the album before you start asking me questions. I'm not going to do your job for you. Mm. I'm not going to ask the question and give you answer. Until you do your homework, don't come back and talk to me.
Yeah.
It is sometimes so disrespectful, and it has been hard. When you're a woman in the music business, it's already difficult. When you're an African woman, it's even worse, because every time the same stupid question comes around, sometimes people want you to be walking around with your titties out. I'm like, not going to happen. Not with this one here. Because if I do that, my mom will come and get me out of that stage and beat the crap out of me. Not gonna happen. And I said, I'm not a museum piece. I'm a human being. And I live in a modern world. I was born in 1960. My father never told me that my skin has to define me. My father and mother never told me that the world, when I leave the house, is not mine to embrace. Wow. My father always said, go out there. Use your brain. Your brain is your ultimate weapon. Just use it. And challenge anyone. You can, with your brain, you can win or not win. But at least don't judge people according to their skin color, because that's where you will lose her. Because that same person can save your life in 5 minutes after you treat the person bad, and something happened to you, that person that you treat as a color gonna be the one that help you. Hmm. So we just gotta be open. And sometimes I just like, is it worth fighting? After a while, yeah. I just stop talking. You ask me a stupid question, I go next. I don't want to answer it because I don't have the energy anymore.
Oh my God, I'm terrified I have a stupid question.
Now, you're doing fine.
Thank you.
I mean, it's just like people just want, I have the feeling that Africa has become the continent where it makes people feel better to say that all the bad thing that is happening is there. Thanks God we're not Africans. Thank God we're not Africa. You're Africans. It's in your DNA. Your ancestor comes from Africa. You say, no, it's your problem. That's the way it is. The music you listen to come from Africa. Blues come from Africa. Rock and roll, by using the same chord as the blues, come from Africa. R&B, hip-hop, whatever music you're listening to today that you can't trace to Africa doesn't exist. You listen to Bach. You have African music in there. He get a lot of music from the Saraband, which is the music of the slave that made it to Mexico City. Yeah. So nobody gonna tell me that the music I'm doing is not African, that is too modern. Because when they call themselves purists, I say, you sound like Hitler to me. There's nothing pure in the world.
Right.
I mean, we cannot be pure. There's nothing pure in the nature. So why should you want to call yourself purist of something? Are you pure?
Right.
If you're pure, you're dead.
Right.
I mean, it's just like that.
It ends,
it's just
right
like
there, right.
It's so schizophrenic.
Yeah.
To try to put us in a category where we can't stop. I mean, I always say to people, don't build my coffin yet. Don't put me in a coffin. The day I die, I'll buy my own coffin. I'll pay for it before I die. Don't put a coffin for me and put me in there. I'm an artist. I'm a human being. I can go anywhere and do my music with anybody in the world. Right now, I can tell you one thing. Philip Glass just wrote a piece based on 3 poems that I gave him from the Yoruba myth of creation of this world. And I did the premiere last Friday in Luxembourg with the Philharmonic Orchestra. So Philip, as Philip put it, he said, we are building a bridge where no one have walked on that bridge yet. Mm. And it has been a tremendous success. Yeah. Just because my father brought classical music when I was a child. Because the first time when I hear Beethoven or Bach, I'm like, oh, come on, what is this thing, man? And my dad said, it's music. I'm like, oh, there's no rhythm in here. I don't why it. So he started playing Beethoven with his banjo. I'm like, okay, I got it. It is painful enough like that. Don't play it. I'll listen to it. And he said, I get my point across. That's all I want you to do. Go listen to it. So I love classical music now. So it's the same thing. Yeah. Classical music is supposed to be the music of the elite. Excuse me, elite. My, okay. Okay, I'm not going there.
So, you know, you have worked with so many different types of artists. I mean, it's really kind of staggering. When you, I knew who you were. I knew that you had done a lot. But when I read through the book, I'm like, my God, I couldn't find anybody like you essentially hadn't worked with.
So maybe like a lot Liberace, of people out there I would love to work with. It's going to come.
Kind of amazing. But this record, your forthcoming record, which comes out next week, mm-hmm. Eve, that's named after your mother?
Yeah, but it's also the story of the first woman.
Yeah, and it's dedicated to the women of Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Our story has been told by men. From the Bible all the way down here. So what is the recounting of the story of Eve? Did anyone give her a chance to tell her part of the story? It's true. I mean, Adam is a man.
Yeah.
All right? So here come Eve and put her feet on his neck and say, get down there and eat the apple. And Adam said, whatever you want, Mr. Sweetheart. And men can't take responsibility for themselves. Hmm. And if they do something wrong, it's always us. So we become that thing that that person they can't live without, but yet they have to bash it. They have to hate it. They have to do whatever they want. I'm like, no, man, I ain't nobody's punching ball, man. You punch me, I punch you back. And here you have my father that always said, as long as your mom is happy and smiling, I'm the most happiest person on the planet. He never stopped my mom from doing theater. He lost many friends between my mom's theater passion and my music passion. People come home and say, how are you going to do this? Blah, 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 blah. My father said, hey, don't come to my house and tell me what I got to do. I don't tell you what to do. If my wife is happy and my family is happy, that's all I'm here for. Mm. I don't decide for nobody what they want to do. I can't decide for myself, so I'm not deciding for nobody. So leave me alone and get the hell out of here. So if my father was a man that loved my mother that much and loved us that much and give us, make me the person that I am today here to go to school, he produced my first show when I did my first album. He has been there all the way. He will film my show and put it 1 week after, go, okay, now, this dress, out. That song, out. You sing off key. I'm like, what else did I have to do? So that's my father. So the story of Eve has defined us all the way down here. Mm. And we are in the 21st century, and the women of Africa never are shown in the media as flamboyant as they are, the resilience they have, the laugh they have, the smile they have. They have so much strength. Every time I go back to Africa, I come back, I'm like, woohoo! I'm on 1,000 voltage. I'm like, I'm ready, man. Come on, bring it. Because they nourish us that much. And the thing also that I really love and learn from them is that they always tell me, it's okay to fail. We are not perfect. But where your strength comes from is how you prevail. When you get off of that floor, when you fall, where do you go? How do you see the future? How do you recreate yourself to have a life after that? Because pain, without pain, there's no love. Without pain, there's no life. And the way you deal with the pain, the loss, and everything that comes your way, hardly the way you rebound is the way that defines you, that makes you a human being that is always able not to close your heart, but always being able to open it and give. Hmm. You'll be always deceived. You can't. I mean, it's human nature to betray.
Yeah.
But you just cannot say that because one person betray you, everybody else have to be put in the same category. I don't live like that. It took me a while to forgive. My mom always said that to me. Angelique, you have to forgive. I mean, somebody make mistake, you can make a mistake too. Between two colors, you have a variety of colors. You just can't go, this is black, this is white. No, you gotta learn. It took me a while before I learned that. And from the moment I learned that, my life got better.
So something that you said in there, you know, people outside of Africa there tends to be an idea about Africa when people think about it, you know, suffering, poverty, and you're talking about, okay, these strong women that you don't usually get to see in the media, at least. As a Goodwill ambassador, you know, you're bringing awareness to situations that are going on there, you know, trying to help women with women's rights, eradicate diseases, you know, eradicating diseases, things like that. I hope I can articulate this, but how do you hit that balance between raising awareness but not perpetuating that only idea that seems to be out there about Africa and the West that, you know, needs help, and there's, you know, because there's so much strength and so much beauty, and it's in your music.
But that's why everybody have been failing. Yeah. Because people are tired of it. You go to a village, you tell them this man is coming to cut, they roll their eyes up. They're gonna come again, throw their money and leave. We are not, I mean, the belief is that they throw bones at us like we're dogs. Hmm. How can you change something without the people being part of the change? Yeah. How can you just decide that they have no brain, they cannot understand the scope of the work that you want to do with them or for them? You can't. That's why people are just tired of it all the way through. So I always say to people, do the thing with the people. You want to go to a village too. That's why UNICEF is lasting so long in Africa. We form the health workers. There can be a retired nurse that we come brought to the table of negotiation. We say, come on, help us give jobs to the young kids that have no job. Help them learn the hygiene around vaccine. We'll provide the bicycle, the vaccine, the container of the, and then we teach, and then you go to the village and vaccinate. Because people, the farmer won't come and leave their farm and come to where you are to get vaccinated. So let's do it. Let's send the people, go to them. If they don't want to do it, don't force them. But before we do that, ask the head of the village, the women community, how can we do this? Who are we going to talk to that will help us get the message through before we get the vaccine out there? Because you come with your vaccine without being prepared. They shut the door on you. Same thing work with HIV AIDS. When we start campaigning, I say, hold on, guys. Every message is in French, English, and bring it to the native language of the people. Because the women won't know to go test it. And today in Africa, most of the part where we have prevalence of HIV AIDS, the women are the face of it. Because the husband goes around and do whatever they want, they bring it home. So they are afraid or ashamed to go to get tested. So they die and they leave orphans. The stigma of HIV AIDS is stronger than the disease itself. So how do we approach that if we don't talk to the people? So there are a lot of stuff that are done like that that doesn't go nowhere. And plus, when you come, you don't identify yourself with the people. You are on this shelf here and you're looking down at them, I'm coming to save you. Who the hell are you? Can you save yourself first before you start saving me? If you don't see me as a human being and you see me as a statistic, you see me as, oh, that person is so poor. I mean, I'm going to bring my money. I'm going to do this. They look at you like, you're going to fail. But we're not going to tell you. You're going to spend all your money here trying so hard. It won't work.
Right.
So that's the failure of AIDS. If we don't work with the people, you got to be committed emotionally. It's not only about money. And that's where it gets complicated. Because as soon as you start getting involved emotionally, and you can see the other, like your sister, your brother, or your child, or your cousin, or your nephew, the perspective that you have about the situation is completely different. Then you can get to the level of the people, sit in the dirt, and say, how we do this? You know your village. How do we do it? Who we go to? How do we build this? You don't do that? We've been sitting here for centuries, again, helping Africa, nothing gonna happen. Nobody wants that kind of help.
Right.
You got to have people be part of the change and impact them to be proud of who they are, not pushing them down. And AIDS has been creating more problems than any solution problem.
We are going to open this up to questions from you. There you are. Okay. And
thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, we're not finished, so I would have.
Hi.
Hello.
I think I heard you on the radio on KPFK months ago.
Well, probably. Yeah, it's true. It's true. I'm always on KPFK.
And I believe, if I'm not incorrect, I believe that part of the conversation was something that there's a stirring awareness of, but pretty dim still in this country, that the United States military has pivoted from the Middle East into Africa, and it's called AFRICOM, and I believe you referred to it. So it's probably a difficult thing to talk about. It's vast and it's secretive, but I'll put it to you this way. You mentioned earlier about how colonialism divided people in Africa against each other. What do you think the legacy of that is living today, and could it be AFRICOM is neo-colonialism? Any thoughts on that subject at all?
Well, colonialism is not over yet for me, if you ask me, because are we still free to make the decision that we wanted for our people? No. And that's the problem of Africa, because when we're talking about problems in Africa, we don't even try to start getting the responsibility of the rich country in place. We don't manufacture weapons in Africa. We don't have any, apart from South Africa, no other countries in Africa manufacture weapons. But yet, we have more weapons than anywhere else. Having access to AK-47 today have allowed men to rape women more easily, because before it was machetes. You can run away from a machetes. But when you have a gun on your head and you know you can't run faster than the bullet, you just give yourself away for how many men want to rape you. So unless we all sit around on the table and decide that the way Africa have divided is perpetrating colonialism today, we won't have a discussion. And I don't think that any rich country wants to take responsibility for what is going on in Africa, and it's better to blame us on what is going on than to say we have a huge play in this. When you know that African debts, and I don't understand why we have debts anywhere with all the richness we have, people are speculating on the African debts, which means they are speculating on the life of children, on the future of people. So AFRICOM or not AFRICOM, if it's just there to just be another force that won't help us get out of our mess, it's another colonization period.
Hi. I think I read a story about you when you were young. You had read about apartheid, and it made you so angry that you went out, you wrote a song about it, and you went out and you sang it for your family, and your father pulled you aside and said, you shouldn't make your music like that. That was after having read about it. Now, as an adult and seeing some of the things you've seen, how do you stop yourself from writing an angry song when you see the things that you've seen?
Well, writing an angry song doesn't bring any solution. That's one of the things that I learned that first time when I wrote that song, because as my father say, as an artist, you are the one that set up the table of negotiation. You are the one that have the key to open doors for people to sit down and talk. Hate doesn't go with music. And I don't like any music that praise hate or music that said women, they call women every different kind of names that is out there. Because, I mean, hey, you can be successful without being disrespectful. As my mother used to say, you can be sexy without being naked, without being vulgar. It's true. I mean, being sexy is the way you wear your clothes. I mean, hey, you don't need to show your butt. You don't need to show your breast. You don't need to show this. I mean, For me, music comes from a place where I don't have any control over. Because when I'm inspired, the music comes and brings the language and brings the vision. And I have colors when I'm writing music. And the colors is transcribed on the album cover all the time. And when I'm about to write a music, I'm always thinking, who will listen to this? How it will impact people's life? How can that music help somebody get to the next day, get to the next level? That's my role as a singer. I'm here to facilitate. I'm here to tell a story that people, I borrow a story from people because I've been reminded about that. I think in 2006, I took a trip to go to the to Chad, to the Darfurian refugee camp in Chad. And the purpose of it, we were eight women. It was a delegation of eight women, American, English, British, German, African. We went there basically to speak to the women of the camp. Because every time we talk about the Darfur stuff, men are the one that you hear everywhere complaining about the camp. So we say we're going to go meet the women. So when we arrive, the men say, no, you can't go to the women. I'm like, okay, I'm out of here. They say, why are you mad? I say, I can't come here to talk to you. I don't care about you right now. I want to speak to the women. And then after, if I have patience and time, I'll talk to you. And because I was with politicians, I was with the former prime minister of Ireland and the former minister of finance of Nigeria. They all say, Angelique, let's deal with it. I say, you do politics. I don't do politics. I'm not good at it. We don't speak to the women. That's the end for me. I'm out of here. So the women... But the men wanted me to come because they know I'm a famous African artist. They want me to sing. I'm like, I ain't singing none to you guys. I'm speaking to the women. So I went to see, we went to see the women. They convinced some of the women not to talk. Instead of having a kind of 100 women, we ended up having 23 women. And it was the worst moment ever in my life. Until today, my sleeping is impacted by that. Story after story, you just discover how horrible we can be to one another. And we didn't know what to do because we were not expecting the story to be so crude and so, oh boy, it was like, I just want to leave. If something could have taken my body out of there and sent me somewhere else, I would have done that. But at the end of that painful afternoon that we spent there, the women said to us, please, you're going to go back out there, speak for us. Whatever you do out there, please don't victimize us. Don't portray us as victim. All we want from you is for you to use your power for this conflict to finish, for us to go back home in safety and security, to be able to raise our children in peace. At that moment, something flipped. I'm like, this is what my father was saying. Use your power to bring people to stop the horror that we inflict on each other, to find what we have in common, to always take the route of that light that we all hold when we come to this planet and let it shine and talk. Until we do that, we won't succeed. Because my father always used to say, when you get into a physical fight, you have lost everything. You have lost your ability of using your brain to talk about peace. So for me, writing music is never going to be about hate. It's never going to be about violence because I don't know how to do so.
I think we have time for one more question.
Oh. There are so many questions.
Hello.
Hello. Hey, Peggy.
You have had such an amazing impact on so many people's lives around the world.
Thank you.
And you're so inspirational. You've absolutely impacted my life. My big question is this wonderful book going to be translated into Fon, Yoruban, and French so that so many people can hear and read these wonderful words?
Well, we try. We try. I mean, it's the French-speaking people are already complaining about the fact that I wrote the book in English. I'm like, ha, ha, ha. You see, there's nothing you can do to please everybody, huh? That's what my grandmother told me when I was 12 years old. You can't please everybody, you can't love everybody, and it goes both ways. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to try, because in Nigeria, there are a lot of countries that read English in Africa, and I'll try to make it also in French. Down the line, we're doing it in Spanish, and I know some people in my country are going to be crazy enough to translate it in front, but I ain't doing that. Nope. It's too difficult to write for. Nobody going to be able to read it but just the 9 million people that live in my country. Yeah. But I think that even in French, people can read it in Benin, and that's what we're working on right now, to find a publisher that is willing to translate in French, because it costs money to translate, actually. And that's the big hurdle that we're facing right now. But let's take the question of that lady in orange there. Right there. And another sister here. So we take two. This? No.
Angelique.
I'm just going to be busted out of here.
Thank you so much for sharing your life and your music with us. And I just wanted to know, how were you inspired to start your foundation?
Oh. Well, my foundation, Batonga, is about secondary education in Africa. I've started campaigning for the Millennium Development Goal of the UN in universal primary education. So I recorded a lot of PSA, as we call it, public service announcement for radio and TV, and started campaign pretty much everywhere in Africa, and mothers start bringing the kids to primary education. So I was in a village in Tanzania, and because I love to speak to the mothers, I love to be with the women. They always teach me something. I always learn something. And mothers came to me and said, well, Angelique, we've seen your PSA. We send our girls to school. Some of them want to continue going to school. What are we going to do for secondary education? I'm like, oh, I never thought about that before. Then my head starts spinning, and I came back to New York. I'm like, I got to do something. And right around the same time, Wangari Maathai received the Nobel Peace Prize. So I did some research about her life, and I found out that when she was a teenager, she received a scholarship from the Kennedy Foundation. And when she finished, she went back and brought, today, we're talking about environment. She was the one that brought that issue into Africa and in Kenya, and then it spread everywhere in Africa. So I said, that's the example of thing that I want to do. I want to be able to give that back to my continent. So a friend of mine put me in contact with two lawyers out of Washington, D.C., and they have a law firm that revived the whistleblowing law. And every trial that we win, they'll put in a fund called Opportunity Fund, and they were already doing work with a hospital in Ethiopia and schools in Ethiopia. And when they met me, they said, we are willing to help. So we started the Batonga Foundation like that, and they put the funding in at the beginning. And right after we started Batonga, USAID come to us and said, please, we have girls. I mean, because we wanted girls that come from very poor background, that were orphans or orphans of AIDS or disabled, to be able to go to secondary education. So we started the foundation in 2006, where we give scholarship, uniform, books, 1 meal a day, tutoring and mentoring program and teacher training. Because the mentor program is very dear to my heart, because I'm not going to be there all the time. So I need men and women to monitor what is going on between the teachers and between the girls and between the family. Because when you start hitting secondary education, you're talking about puberty. And if you keep them 3 years in the secondary education, then they escape early marriage. So secondary education is very crucial in Africa, and that's why most of the parents don't want to hear anybody talk about secondary education, because if the girls stay home after the primary education, they get married after that. So when I started in 5 countries: Benin, Mali, Cameroon, Sierra Leone, and Ethiopia. In Sierra Leone, we built a school and a well. And my friend Bonnie that is here helped us find the money to the well to start the well from scratch and finish it in the school, because they need clean water for the toilet. The girls' toilet was different. Just the needle behind the door make a difference for the girls to come to school, because they can put their clothing there. And Batonga is a small foundation. because I prefer to start small and have result than be big everywhere and not have no result. And the girls, I know them, and the parents sometimes comes to talk to me because I want to meet the parents. I want the support, because without the parents' support, I can't do it. And we are realizing now that we have one program in Ethiopia where we give a microloan to the mother. Then she pays for the tuition. And it's very successful because you empower the mother, and she's proud of keeping that girl in school. And that is something that we're going to replicate everywhere, because you have to empower the mothers for them to be able to play the role of parents without depending on anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome.
Angelique, thank you so much for coming. I followed your career. First time I saw you was at Luna Park.
Yeah, I remember that.
Long time. Two of us are here from the Los Angeles sister city with Bahia, Brazil. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to your experience in Bahia?
Wow, that was a good one. Well, most of the people that live in Salvador de Bahia come from Benin. And the culture is so vividly alive in Salvador de Bahia. And it was amazing for me to walk into Pelourinho and smell the same food that
wow.
I mean, you land and you're like, I'm like, it smells like my country. And the culture of Africa is so alive. And I was invited to go to a candomblé. And I was like, well, let me see how African this is. And I was like, oh my God. They were singing in Yoruba a song that I knew since I was a child. Wow. And I don't speak Portuguese. I was sitting there like, I'm like, what is this? So clear and so articulate. And one of the things that I did there, because I knew that Salvador gonna grab my heart. So I said, I don't wanna go to no fancy hotel. I wanna go to a small bed and breakfast close to Pelourinho. Pelourinho is a place in Salvador de Bahia that used to be the place where they exposed the slave for people to come and buy them. So I found a place, a gallery that does bed and breakfast. So we went there. It's still there, but it's owned by a French guy. So he said, okay, give me your story. Why do you want to stay here? You are a star. I'm like, I'm not a star. Don't start giving me star stuff, man. Come on, leave me. I want to see the real people. I want to work with kids of this. I want to meet the kids here. He said, okay, I'll take you tonight to a meeting. There's a young guy called Miguelito, whatever. And then he's 19 years old, and he quit school to take care of the kids in the street. He actually get a building that belongs to the government and say, I don't care, this is going to be our place, where he used music to get them to quit sniffing glue or to prostitute. And the foundation was called Bagunçaço, which is me brother, if you want. That's what I mean. I'm like, okay, whatever, let's go for it. So I started working with those kids, and my first experience was with a little boy that came late. But the rule is strict. You have to be on time. He came late, and he was so ashamed. And I said, what is wrong? He looked so miserable. I said, oh, what is wrong? He didn't have the money to buy soap, to wash the only shirt that he had. That's why he was late. I said, I don't care about your dirty shirt. Come on. I grabbed him on my lap, and he was like, huh? I said, you want us to do some music? He said, yes. I said, bring the drums, man. And we start playing. And that music, I put it, actually, the music that I record with them, I put it in my version of Redemption Song that I did.
Wow.
So that was my experience. It was absolutely amazing.
Thank you. So... thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You are amazing. And thank you. And please stay because she's going to perform.
Dominic, where are you? Let's do this.
Also, if you like programs like these, please support the library because they do a lot of wonderful things like this. So thank you.
Library are important.
for people like me, it saved my life. What do you want to do first? Are you sure? Whatever. He's the boss, not me. Malaika, nakupenda malaika, malaika, nakupenda malaika, na milifanye te, Inge kuwa malaika. Yeba. Pesa. Zasubu waroho nyengu. Pesa. Zasubu waroho nyengu. Na. Ki jana mwezi nyowo nashindwa na mali sinawe ingekuwa malaika nashindwa na mali sinawe Inge kuwa malaika. Kirege. Ukuwa hasa kirege. Kikiteke. Ukuwa za kirege. No. Nashindwa na mali sinawe chongli ingekuwa malaika Nashindwa na mali sinawe ingekuwa malaika ingekuwa Malaika, ingekuwa malaika, ingekuwa malaika.
Thank you. Dominic James on guitar.
Awalole riegbe mi ni baba. Awalole riegbe iwo ni baba. Awalole riegbe mi ni baba o. Awalole riegbe iwo ni baba. To ba fe gbe gugun ni o awani. To ba fe gbe orisa o awani. Awalole riegbe mi ni baba o. Awalole riegbe iwo ni baba. Awalole riegbe mi ni baba. Awalole riegbe iwo ni baba. To ba fe gbe leri o awani. To ba fe gbe oga o awani. Awa. Awa na eleri awa woni ta lo fe so were logbon o awa awa na eleri awa ta lo fe so were logbon o awa
awa na ele ri awa. Yeah, ani we me no pohe wagbelo. Mini Baba, Agualo Lady, whoa, Agualo Lady, baby, Mini Baba, oh, Agualo Lady, baby, one Baba, Toba Fek, Gungunio, Awani, Toba Fek, Orisha, oh, Awani, Agualo Lady, baby, Mini Baba, oh, Agualo Lady, baby, one Baba. Awani, 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 toba fekbe orisha o, awani, 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 yeah, lo leri ekbe iwoni baba, awalo leri ekbe imini baba o, awalo leri ekbe iwoni baba, awalo leri ekbe iwoni baba, awalo leri ekbe iwoni baba. Thank you.
Oh, I can breathe now.
Well, this song that we just played, Awa Lole, it's going to be on the next album. It's a song talking about conversation that I have with some young children, young kids, adolescents, and in Africa, especially in Benin and other places where they are like, they were telling me, we're going to be the next leader of this world. And you want real leaders, you come to us, because we're going to be right here telling you how to do it. And this one is called Kulumbu. No, Kulumbu first. Oh, what the hell? I'm doing Kulumbu. I'm the one telling you what I have to do. Okay. So Kulumbu is about peace. Kulumbu is how it's dove, actually. And this song is about peace talk that happened after conflict. Why can't women sit on the peace talk table to make the peace last longer? They are the first victim of conflict. Irawa o irawa e irawa o irawa e irawa irawa o irawa e irawa o irawa e irawa isha wan leta o she isha wan leta o she Ashiri wa o kambo chichi lo lae lae Kulumbu e ye o ye ye kulumbu 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 Yeba Irawa o irawa e irawa o irawa e irawa irawa o irawa e irawa o irawa e irawa o ife wan leta o she ife wan leta o she ashiri wa kambo titi lo aye lai wa ba churumbu aye 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 kurumbu kurumbu aye 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 kurumbu kurumbu aye 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 kurumbu kurumbu aye 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 kurumbu ashiri ni aye oye wa kala wa o. O kan bale aye ise gbogbo wa ni o 1 2 3 go Kulumbu aye 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 kulumbu Kulumbu aye 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 kulumbu O kan bale aye ise gbogbo ni o e wa kalo aburo mi o e wa kalo fe ife o e wa kamalo kulumbu eye kulumbu eye kulumbu eye o kulumbu eye o ye ye kulumbu e wa kalo fe kulumbu eye o Ahe, ahe, hey. Kulumbu eye, kulumbu eye, kulumbu.
Thanks for clapping. So now let's sing together the last song. Thank you so much. This song, you know it, is a blessing song that I wrote for my continent. And also, it's a song that I wrote just to celebrate our cultural differences. Anything we want, because we are unique. Even though we belong to the same human family, we got to let our light shine. We have to tell our stories, because every story matters. Afirika.
Ashe, mama, Afirika. Ashe mama, ashe mama, Africa, you know it, let me go. That's what I'm talking about, girlfriend. Come on, don't be shy. I want the volume. That's what the Los Angeles I know, come on. Okay. All right, hold it like that. Don't drop it. Don't drop the ball. I started, and I'm gonna tell you, let's go. You do it. Can we do it? Yeah. Me be found Africa gelo, me when I'm from Bamonde, but don't be the solution la me wede, me de manali dat pe mi chon, ye famboro nyanya ton rawe, Africa me be say ton we, me no mi be nyanya, let's go!
Shame, mama Africa,
mama Africa,
mama, shame, mama Africa,
mama Africa,
mama, shame, mama Africa,
mama.
Africa.
Yes,
mama Africa.
Ha! Me de le chimpanzee, ba me de le fondo nu wa go yu na ye Africa me bi se tonwe, mi nu mi gbe nyanya. Let's go.
She mama Africa.
Mama Africa.
She mama Africa.
Africa. Mama Africa.
Mama Africa.
Nisho. Me be found Africa gelo, me when I found but more that better. Me the solution la me wade, me the man all in that way me talk. Get found but oh, nyanya turn away. Africa, men be say to we, me no me be nyanya. Let's go!
Shema, Africa.
Mama wa Africa.
Shema, Africa.
Mama wa Africa.
Shema, Africa.
Mama wa Africa.
Shema, Africa.
Whoa, ho, ho, wa Chile.
Shema,
ba wa yano. Africa, Mama Africa, Mama Africa,
Mama
Africa, Mama Africa, Mama Africa, Ashe mama Africa. Love you. See you out there. Thank you. Dominic James on guitar. Thank you. Thanks. Come on.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.